I warned you I might get political on occasion. Today's one of those occasions. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Season 5, Episode 8 of the Real Spies, Real Lives podcast. This is where we talk about writing, spies, and writing about spies. I'm your host, espionage author P.A. Duncan. Alexei Navalny didn't die in prison. He was murdered there. This isn't precisely espionage-related or writing-related in a way, and what I'm about to say is my opinion, or, you might say, how I would write it in a story or a novel. And much like I never speak or fully write the name of the twice impeached, multiple times indicted former president, I also won't say the name of a certain Eastern European dictator. And I'm not talking about Milosevic. I'll say his name. Alexei Navalny was likely murdered last week in a prison north of the Arctic Circle. I personally believe the dictator wanted him dead a long time ago. There's a history, of course, of murdered opposition leaders, of which Navalny was one, reporters, perceived enemies and out-of-favor politicians, defectors, generals, and probably a lot more. The methods have been varied: poison, nuclear and conventional, gang violence, drive-by shootings, a lot of mysterious falls from fifth-floor windows, the infamous ailment from the Soviet era, the heart attack, aircraft coming apart in midair. Again, I'm sure there are more. Navalny, however, had a large popular following, and a death soon after his return to Russia from medical treatment in Germany, for having been poisoned, would have been too convenient, too suspicious. One has to distance oneself from the people you want dead. Maybe the dictator took a page from the friends of Milosevic's dying playbook. Who knows? However the means or the motivation, it happened. Alexei Navalny is dead. Well, exactly who was he? To me, he is a Russian patriot, a man who envisioned Russia as a democracy, no one-man rule for him. He was an optimist in the face of the ultimate pessimism. That, as Nathan Hodge put it in CNN, was an existential threat to the one man ruling Russia. Yes, in the face of such optimism, totalitarianism cannot exist. So, in short, Navalny had to go. But Navalny had managed to inspire countless Russians to take to the streets in record numbers and voice loudly and openly their opposition to the oligarchs, the all-encompassing corruption, to the dictator himself. Even in the face of brutal police and security services' reaction to their protests, they returned, day after day, protests spread from Moscow to many other Russian cities. The offices of not only the lawyer Navalny, but of his supporters, among a sort of amorphous opposition in Russia, were raided. Protesters were hauled away, jailed, or exiled. Navalny, now under constant surveillance by Russia's security and intelligence services, was eventually poisoned by Novichok, but survived. Indeed, he was allowed to leave Russia to be treated in Germany for the poisoning, and he survived. I'm sure there was at least one person who was surprised by that. He could have stayed there in Germany in, as Hodge puts it, comfortable exile. But Navalny was an optimist, remember. He could see a better Russia, and against all advice, he returned to his homeland and was promptly arrested. In a trial reminiscent of those for Stalin's purges, Russian prosecutors came up with new charges against Navalny almost daily. But at each court appearance, Navalny, the lawyer, continued to speak out for that alternate Russia he saw in his mind. In court, he called the dictator a naked king and spoke of the crown slipping from his head as more and more people spoke out against him, the naked king. But this, I think, is Navalny's best quote. "Your naked king wants to rule until the end. He doesn't care about the country. He is clung to power and wants to rule indefinitely." That sounds familiar, doesn't it, considering the current election cycle here in the United States? Now, there is no doubt Russian prisons of any ilk are horrific, brutal places. Many years ago, I watched a documentary on the Russian penal system, and it's nightmarish. Food, you wouldn't feed pigs. Indeed, Navalny complained about his breakfast of boiling water instead of tea, but it was called tea, and bread that was inedible. Constant brutish interrogations, the smallest of infractions punished with reduced rations and solitary confinement in a concrete room no more than a box. Hard, backbreaking labor. There is a reason the Tsars and the Communists put their gulags and prisons in Siberia. It's a harsh land with harsh conditions, especially in the winter. But Navalny endured all the Russian prison system tossed at him and never lost his optimism, his vision for Russia. He remained composed and even exhibited he could still enjoy making a joke about the type of music blasted through his last prison, designated IK3, and situated north of the boundary of the Arctic Circle in the Yamal-Nenets region. On Valentine's Day, Navalny posted an older picture of him and his wife Yulia on Russian social media. He spoke of the distance between them and concluded with, "But I feel that you are near every second, and I love you more and more." 2 days later, according to official Russian government statements, he collapsed while walking outside with his guards. Prison medical personnel allegedly tried to revive him but couldn't. He was 47 years old. No cause of death has been provided other than, quote, "sudden death syndrome," unquote. Indeed, at the time I scripted this episode, the location of his body is unknown. But as of Wednesday, yesterday, it was supposed to have been found in a morgue in a hospital not far away from the prison. Now, if this were my story to write, and it may be one day, I would certainly have had the prison warden receive a phone call from the dictator with vaguely worded but completely understandable instructions for the handling of this prisoner. However, that's dramatic license. Very Stalinesque, however, which is somewhat appropriate given the dictator's admiration for that mad Georgian. The dictator, like any of them throughout history, has people around him who can, shall we say, anticipate the dictator's desires concerning any enemies real or perceived, like the knights around King Henry II, who heard the king's complaints about a troublesome priest and promptly murdered Archbishop of Canterbury Thomas à Becket in his cathedral. Surround yourself with enough sycophants, and you never have to give a direct order. Granted, most of Navalny's supporters in Russia and in the West, myself included, suspected what the ultimate outcome would be when Navalny was sentenced to up to 30 years in prison for trumped-up charges. That amount of time in and of itself is almost a death sentence in a Russian prison, anyway. Navalny himself probably understood it, too. But that never suppressed his vision of a better Russia. Dictators don't understand this. The human mind and its imagination cannot be suppressed. Still, his death was a shock. Indeed, it took me days to be able to write of it or speak of it. And even now, it's difficult for me to believe that it actually happened, despite reality. It's called denial. Yeah, I've been to therapy. Next month, Russia will have an election. Well, they call it an election. I don't know if you'd really consider it a true election. And the dictator will likely win his fifth term, because any opposition that might have unseated him is either disqualified from the ballot, exiled, or dead. This is something we here in the United States, with politicians and some self-declared journalists falling over themselves to kick that dictator's arse and do his bidding, need to understand. This is a dim and dismal future that we here must repulse, not welcome, not covet. I've seen several memes going around social media along the lines of, my father or grandfather fought fascism, etc., and all we have to do is vote in November. So here's my version. When he was 17, my father left the family farm, crossed an ocean to fight fascism, waded a river with a bazooka held over his head, and disabled a Nazi tank that had been killing his fellow soldiers, fought in the Battle of the Bulge in one of the coldest winters in decades in Europe, collected enough bits of shrapnel in his arms and chest that they'd still pop out of his flesh decades later. And he liberated Nazi concentration camps. All I have to do is vote in November. That's the same vision, the same optimism that Navalny had. I wish the Russian people had the same opportunity to have their votes mean something as they do here. Rest in power, Alexei Navalny. Okay, I recognize, given what I just talked about, this is a very bad segue, but now it's commercial time. Today is February 22nd, so we have today and tomorrow left, tomorrow being February 23rd, 2024, for the free days to download all four books of my 9/11 series, Meeting the Enemy. Yes, four books, novels, the whole series, free to download for two more days, the ebooks. On the first day they were on sale, 150 people downloaded them. That's a dozen authors' heart, really good. Early in book three, considering, again, the subject matter we spoke of and the person that I didn't name above, in book three, Treachery, I have a scene where my fictional, emphasis fictional, Russian dictator demands a return of all the money Alexei Bukharin looted from old KGB accounts to finance his warlord army in Afghanistan. But it's Mai Fisher who deals with a ruthless man with her own ruthlessness. It's one of my favorite scenes, so you might have to buy or download for free all three books just to read that scene. So, better hurry and grab those free ebooks before midnight on February 23rd, 2024. Also, next month, March, the featured sale book will be my debut mystery novel, No Spies in This One, which is having its first book birthday in March. And that book that came out last year was Supreme Madness of the Carnival Season. So, stay tuned. And commercial over. Since we're closing in on the end of February, where I featured all four books in that series, Meeting the Enemy, I'll read from the final book in the series, Rendition. The title is self-explanatory. But the scene I'm reading sets the reader up for another series coming in 2025, where Mai Fisher has a very different role in the directorate from what she has had all of her career. Meeting the Enemy, Rendition, Chapter 55, January 15th, 2004, Directorate Headquarters. Mai Fisher paused on her walk from the car to the elevator. She'd entered the directorate this way hundreds, if not thousands, of times. Indeed, 6 or so weeks from now would mark 27 years since she'd entered for the first time. Today, though, was different enough to be surreal. "What is wrong?" Alexei asked from beside her. "Is it too late to change my mind?"
Yes. "What are you worried about? You'll do fine."
"What sexual favors can I do for you to make certain you stay my consultant for, like, ever?"
"I'll think of a few, but they won't change my mind. 1 year, 2 at the most, for you to build the confidence you already have in spades, and you're on your own, as you should be. I am looking forward to doing nothing except cooking, woodworking, playing my piano, cruising the Potomac on my boat, and welcoming my wife home from work each evening. In fact, I am counting the days. However, none of that will happen unless you get in that elevator."
"Oh, I'm fine, right here." His hand came to rest on her shoulder, fingers squeezing.
"Think of this as simply another mission," he said. "You're always the best on missions."
She considered that, sighed, and continued to the elevator. Inside, Alexei stood close to her, their arms touching, his fingers brushing, then clasping her hand.
"Public displays of affection," Mai said, a smile ghosting on her mouth. I have no issue with anyone knowing I'm sleeping with the boss, he said.
Ha! That'll get you no perks, mi boyo.
He leaned down, lips at her ear. Not even if I... The elevator doors opened, and he straightened, releasing her hand. Harry, the chief of headquarters security, greeted Mai with what could only be described as the smile of a proud parent. He held himself as tall as his 5'5" would allow, his shoulders squared, his eyes gleaming.
Good morning, Deputy Director, he said. A wonderful day, isn't it?
Mai put her briefcase on the table for examination, unclipped her gun, and lay it there, too. For you, perhaps. I feel as if I'm about to start a long prison sentence.
Ignore her, Alexei said, doing the same with his briefcase.
He'd opted to leave the gun at home. That's what I do when she's being cranky. That was amusing and true, but Mai felt compelled to give Alexei a glare. Mai stepped through the screening station and collected her briefcase and gun from Harry. Alexei passed through next, and Harry hustled to the next elevator and punched in the code.
I hope your first day goes well, Deputy Director,
Harry said, grinning like a fool.
Have you forgotten my name? Mai asked. Of course not. It's just so damned exciting.
Harry.
Yes, Deputy Director?
Get a life. The enthusiastic, even anticipatory atmosphere was heightened when the elevator deposited her and Alexei at the operations level. Analysts and department heads rushed to welcome Mai, shake her hand, and assure her they were looking forward to working with her. Even all those who'd worked with her before. From his desk in ops, Nelson watched, wearing a sly smile. Mai brought it to an end. Thank you, everyone, for the well wishes. I'm sure you'll regret them when you discover what a bitch I really am, she said. As usual, Nathan Hempstead lightened the moment.
Oh, Fisher, we already know that, trust me. We given you the benefit of the doubt.
Milder than his usual patois. Mai and Alexei went to Nelson's desk.
Am I supposed to say reporting for duty or some such? Mai asked.
Oh, hell no, Nelson said, levering himself to his feet with his canes.
But you do get to attend your first department head staff meeting. Oh, they're glorious fun, let me tell you. But watch me and learn how to look like you're interested in every word spoken.
Mai looked up at Alexei. I'd like to go home now. He gave her that damnable Russian shrug.
In for a penny, he said, and followed Nelson.
I'm never that cheap, Mai muttered, and followed too. Mai paused in the doorway to Grace Lydell's office and tapped on the door. Grace looked up from the numerous documents on her desk, her face impassive, and leaned back in her chair.
How can I help you, Deputy Director? Grace asked in a thick monotone.
If I get called that one more time, it's reality, Deputy Director. What do you want?
You weren't at the staff meeting this morning. Busy. I sent an actor.
She pushed four thick file folders to the corner of her desk. What we have on the Madeline Byrne, Bill Noling, Zelma Nisbet, and Winston Everett occurrences, per your request.
Oh, they're not for me. They're for you.
Me? Why?
Because you will spot things, make connections others won't.
Your first day on the job, and you're giving me scut work.
All right, let's clear the air, shall we?
Grace, I didn't think sending Sharon Pumphrey to Gitmo for field experience was a grand idea.
No, it was my idea. But you were in charge there. You could have said no and sent her home alive instead of the way she arrived, in a box. I'm the one who went to her funeral and told her parents the lie about a mugging on the streets of Washington, D.C., not you. You were on, Grace's mouth drooped, sabbatical. You think I don't know that? That I don't think of that every minute of every day? Mai said. She's not that much older than Natalia, and I think of that, too. You need me to apologize? I'm sorry, beyond words. You need me to accept the blame? Mea culpa. Mea maxima culpa. I'm a department head with dozens of missions in various stages of planning and execution. I don't have time for analyst grunt work. Aren't you grooming Elizabeth Drake for when you retire? She certainly thinks that. She would. And I won't be retiring for a while yet. She still needs a lot of grooming. Again, I'm too busy to be your personal analyst. Why don't you use Drake for your little project? You want to be mad at someone. Be mad at Alexei. He stopped me from killing Sharon's killer. Mai nodded to the files in the corner of the desk. Link those four events to Security Solutions, and you'll have the people responsible for Sharon's death, for her murder. The proof has to be solid, irrefutable. No one can do that properly except you. Don't fucking flatter me. I'm not. I'm stating the truth I've known since I first set foot here. Hand it off to Drake if you want, but you are the only one who can make the case so that it can't be denied. I know that, you know that. In fact, you know bloody well if I'd given it to someone else, you'd be darkening my office door telling me how inept I am. Grace stared at her, unblinking, unrelenting. We have the man who raped and killed Sharon, Mai said, her voice lower, calmer. But that's not enough. I want, and I know you do too, to take down the company that uses rape and murder as a standard business practice. So what if Sharon's killer is convicted and sent to prison? The people who encouraged that modus operandi would still be in business and will continue to be unless you link them to these events. Mai rested a hand on the files. Grace's expression was unchanged. What's the timeline? However long it takes. Grace didn't move for a minute, perhaps two. She opened a drawer in her desk, the left one, top, the one where Mai knew she placed her highest priority projects. Grace took the folders, dropped them inside, and slammed the drawer closed. Anything else, Deputy Director? Grace asked. Mai took out her small Moleskine and tore a page from it. This is a list of Madeline Byrne's assets she ran when she was in the field. Now that she's been burned and her image splashed all over television and magazines, she'd like to know what happened to them. The CIA has cut her off, and I promised her I'd find out. That's not in Russian, by the way. She used the Cyrillic alphabet to spell the names and countries phonetically. Put Drake on that if you want. You could have given this to Drake. Jesus, wept Grace. If I'd given a project to one of your analysts without consulting you, we both know what you'd have done. I'll concede that. She held up the slip of paper. Why are you doing this? Consider it penance. Mai turned to go. God, you'll do anything not to go to confession, won't you? Mai stopped and turned back to look at Grace. An amused gleam shone from Grace's eyes, still shrouded by anger, but it was a start. Mai took hope from it. Of course I will. I'm allergic to priests, Mai said, and again turned to go. Mai, you'll do fine, as deputy director, eventually as director. Without turning around, Mai replied, I'm glad someone thinks so. Well, I hope that piqued your interest. For the rest of this year, 2024, and into 2025, I'm focusing on some standalone novels featuring my spies, of course. But I'm also working on a second mystery. So this new series that I'm hinting about in that reading, Enemies Domestic, won't start until the latter part of 2025 or maybe even early 2026. So stay tuned. So despite all that work ahead of me, rest assured, I'll use every opportunity to keep an eye out for spies. The proceeding has been a production of Unexpected Paths Media, copyright 2024, all rights reserved. Join us next week for a new episode of the Real Spies, Real Lives podcast. In 2 days, it will be the second anniversary of Russia's invasion of the sovereign nation of Ukraine. Slava Ukraini!